Okay, so thanks for this opportunity. I could not join this wonderful program earlier than December 7th because of teaching obligations. In fact, the teaching was further impeded by Carlos inviting us to a beautiful workshop in Brazil, and then I clocked all kinds of missed classes and I spent December 6th making up. And then I traveled here on December 7th, but I was watching the videos just to kind of see what's going on, and I saw in one of the videos Rembert wrote spintronics, topology, quantum, and this talk is pretty much going to have all three. So for example, quantum is here, spintronics means I'm going to shoot all kinds of spin current, spin torque, spin densities in these systems, and then there will be a little bit of topology, but not topological materials. This will be topology in real space because some of these non-linear magnetic textures do have a non-trivial topological numbers in real space, and if you start jerking them around, moving them around, these topological numbers have to be conserved. So the most important item on this first slide is actually this address, because any reference I put in red ink you could quickly get from my publication site instead of digging through the publisher website, checking if you have access via some proxies and things like that. Okay, so the most important slide, people who contributed to this, so this is my current postdoc, who is also expert in aesthetics, so most of these beautiful movies you're going to watch, and this talk is a lot about movies, so even if you're not expert, you should be able to follow, are done by my current postdoc, Marko Petrović. Then there is a graduate student, Utkarsh Bajpayee, former postdoc, Bogdan Popescu, and to optimize things, there is also help from my colleague in Applied Mathematics Department at University of Delaware. So the papers on which these talks are based are recent, from 2018. This one is still unpublished on archive, and this is the one I'm actually just now trying to finalize while observing beautiful landscape I have from my office window, which is Pacific Ocean and palm trees. So in any case, if anybody wants to take a look at this manuscript or discuss it or provide any suggestions, I'm open to all kinds of possible collaborations while we're still here in the program. So it is always advantageous in the world of spintronics, especially if you're giving talk to experimentalists and people who work with applications, to start with something real. So the real thing is, like, what can we do with this non-linear magnetic texture? So either magnetic domain walls or skirmions that we have been also covering in this program can be used to create the so-called racetrack memories, pioneered at least as a concept by Stuart Parkin. And here is actually a movie which shows how these things would operate. So you would encode zeros and ones in the presence or absence of a magnetic domain wall, and then you would move them around by current in a controllable fashion, so you have to know exactly where the domain wall is, and then you could read off that information. And even though none of this stuff is really implemented in any practical device, Stuart Parkin is already talking about 4.0 version of these racetrack memories. So the essence is that they would provide a very low dissipation. Skirmions would be even better because you can move them without being stuck by any disorder. There are other things you can do with domain walls. You could create these counterparts of neurons and neural networks. And then there is this idea which actually belongs to So Take, who is not here anymore, about using even domain walls as some kind of platform to create room temperature qubits. So another topic that we are going to actually look very closely, besides trying to drive these magnetic domain walls by current, is this recent experiment that was published in 2017 in Nature Physics, done by Beach Group, which is one of the leading groups in experimental spintronics. So what he did, he took this ferromagnetic nanowire, and then he created two magnetic domain walls close to each other. Eventually, as you will see in my theoretical analysis, these two domain walls have opposite topological charge. So even if they vanish, the topological charge is going to be conserved. And then he applies magnetic field. Here is the magnetic field. And it initiates dynamics of these two magnetic domain walls. And after some time, they disappear. And what is left afterwards is a spin wave traveling in this direction. And that spin wave is detected by jerking this third domain wall, or by doing what Garrett named in one of the viewpoints and papers, transmutation of spin wave or magnon into electron, and that spin current of transmuted spin wave to electron is then eventually detected by inverse pinhole effect. And they are very careful when they do this business, so they did multiple proofs that what they observe is really annihilation to magnetic domain walls. There is actually a much wider field of annihilation of topological solitons. This is a monograph. If you open it up, you will see topological soliton annihilation in liquid helium, in cosmology, in liquid crystals. And all of these things have some shared features. So the most dangerous stuff, I think far dangerous than any kind of global warming, would be, for example, this deep brain, if you believe in string theory, on which we live in, gets annihilated with another deep brain coming from somewhere in the universe, and then you have some flux of tachyons which wipes out not just planet Earth, but everything throughout the whole galaxy. So fortunately, string theory is not still ironed out to really lead to this scenario. In any case, if you look at this book, they tell you the pattern of this annihilation is very violent. It's a purely non-equilibrium phenomenon. I mean, a lot of stuff about non-equilibrium we don't really understand, no matter from which subfield it's coming from. And most often, you have to model this numerically. And the standard in the experimental community has been classical micromagnetics. In fact, on Friday, I went to UC Riverside, and one of the experimental guys there, young guys, is telling me, let me show you my lab. I go with him into the basement, and he says, one third of my lab is not experiment anymore. It's actually a bunch of computers lined up with all the GPU cards donated by NVIDIA, and the guy is running, he says, 24/7 micromagnetic simulations. Why? Because he says they're going to see some idea to what to prove experimentally. And vice versa, like Beach does in this paper, they want to confirm that what they see can be explained by micromagnetics. So in other words, there is a huge fear of general public that AI and all these new technologies are going to take their jobs. In this case, it is the fear for us, theoretical spintronics people, that these guys who are running micromagnetics codes in the basement of their lab are going to take the job away from us. So I'm going to convince you here that there are some missing items from classical micromagnetics, which is going to prolong us still being required for this guy. So basically,
what I'm already like several years, well, maybe I've always been of the opinion that these guys are better at doing micromagnetics than I am.
No, true, but there are quantum corrections to micromagnetics, and at the end of the talk, I'm going to show you what is missing in this analysis Beach has done.
What they are doing is experiments. And to interpret those, you
need or vice versa, that this guy is running his micromagnetics to get inspiration to what he wants to do. So in other words, he says, I don't need you, a theorist, I'm just running these computers 24/7.
Without theorists, he doesn't understand what comes out of this complication calculation.
No, true, true, but what I'm saying is that if you look at this paper, like on the in the list of authors, there is no theorist. They just pick up their own code from off the shelf, they run the code, and they say, look, whatever we observed is what we get from micromagnetics. So in that sense, the computer replaces you being in his lab and discussing with
him. That is what band structure calculations gave such a bad name, because people use it as a black box.
Yeah, well, but the thing is that what I'm trying to say is that even if you have a theorist who uses this in any kind of box, black or white, my talk is about missing effects. So I'm going to show you toward the end of the talk, this is just a kind of overture, that there is a lot of stuff happening in this experiment or any other one which they use micromagnetics, which you cannot capture by micromagnetics, but you need somebody also doing quantum science, which is another buzzword, especially here now in the US. So in any case, there is also a paper that was actually published by Oleg Chernyshov, which is also micromagnetics, but he combines micromagnetics with some analytical theory, so then micromagnetics serves to tune analytical theory. But in any case, in all of this analysis of this annihilation phenomenon, there is no anything quantum. Everything is done purely classically. And by the way, some of these images are very nice because they tell you, for example, why is the application of magnetic field going to move the domain wall? As you can see, once you apply magnetic field, this guy wants to expand because it slows the free energy at the expense of the white spin, and then eventually you see the wall moving. Or if you have an annihilation, this region, for example, here in the middle, wants to contract. This expands to reduce the free energy, and then you see an annihilation in the simplest possible guise without doing heavy calculation.
Can I ask a question about this this beach experiments? What is kind of the, let's say, the motivation?
Is the motivation, kind of, that's a good point. So when people do spintronics experimentally, there's always two motivations. One could be fundamental physics, let's do annihilation of the stuff which you can do in the lab as opposed to deep brains or some cosmological stuff which is inaccessible to experiment. Then there is a technological application. So in this particular case, the technological application is that they generated very short wavelength spin waves of the so-called exchange type. And this is the key thing for the so-called magnonics, which you also work on. So like there are other methods to do it, but they require very large magnetic fields, all kinds of antennas and things like that. In this fashion, you generate very short spin waves, and that then gives you access to all these beautiful interference effects, which look exactly like light, but light requires hundreds of nanometers devices because of the long wavelength. So one of the major things about magnonics is you have a wave, you can do interference experiments like as you do with waves, but everything can be done on a scale of less than 100 nanometers. Eventually, the goal here is to reduce the wavelength of the spin wave to 10 nanometers. That would be like some pragmatical technological aspect, and that's exactly why he did it. He doesn't say that this is in the title, he doesn't say this in the title, but he says that there was a spin wave burst. And the spin waves are very special because it's not easy. There are only a few other techniques to generate. Usually the spin waves are long wavelength dipole dominated rather than the short wavelength exchange interaction dominated. So when these first micromagnetics codes, such as the famous OOMF, have been developed in 1990s, the first thing they checked is what is the pattern of localized magnetic moments within the wire containing the domain wall. And this is, for example, OOMF running the calculation, which means basically means from the viewpoint of theoretical physics, reduce the free energy. And if you set up, these are all metastable states, by the way. So like if you really go to the true ground state, it would always be ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic, depending on exchange coupling. But if you push it in some kind of local minimum, such as this one here, you could have one domain pointing this way, the other domain pointing that way, and then in between you have magnetic domain wall as the interpolation between the two domains, yes.
Since we're using it to a macromagnetic simulation, can you quickly sketch what exactly you mean?
That's coming up, yeah. So I will give a little bit, one slide crash course on micromagnetics. So at this point, we just look at the result of micromagnetics. So here is a nice result because it tells you if the nanowire is less than 50 nanometers wide, this is the pattern of the domain wall. If the wire is wider than 50 nanometers, then you get this vortex domain wall. And if you start integrating this angle along the edges, you could even get topological charges. This is, by the way, a nice review of these topological properties of this nonlinear magnetic texture that was written by Oleg Chernyshov, again, earlier attendant of this program. So,
is this an XY magnet system or?
No, this is just a regular ferromagnetic metallic nanowire with easy axis.
Okay.
So it has like, let's say, J, SIF, J term in the Hamiltonian, and then there is minus SZ square term that likes to line up all the spins in some particular direction.
With open boundary conditions?
I don't know those details because you have to look at the paper. I think it was, it depends what you mean. Yeah, it would be hard wall or open boundary conditions, yeah. So there is no periodicity, for example, along this edge being connected to that edge. So this would be like a magnetic domain wall in equilibrium. And for my purpose, since I don't want to model anything 2D, that would be very expensive eventually, and it is better to get intuition on the simplest example, I'm just going to look at this 1D, which is a slice of this real magnetic domain wall that, which comes from micromagnetics. And of course, it's not easy to image this by any technique. Like if you're using, for example, MOC, you could scan the position of magnetic moments, but you're not going to have with the light resolution of 3 angstroms. So that's why you need this micromagnetics to see the details. And I'm going to focus just on this kind of one slice of the domain wall, which is going to be some one-dimensional examples. This slide comes from the review article by Tatara Sensei, in which he tells you that once you inject a current and push this domain wall out of equilibrium, which would be the name of the game of the slide I show you to create these racetrack memories, then you could have a reflection, which is going to exert a force on the domain wall. You could have transmission, which is going to exert spin torque that we also have to do a crash course on, and eventually you're going to get a whole new set of phenomena once you have domain walls out of equilibrium as compared to the previous slides when everything was in equilibrium. So like pretty much anything that you do in spintronics has to be out of equilibrium physics, which is why it becomes interesting for a theorist as long as there is something quantum to do, because as I said, anything that is classical, these guys will do with their artificial intelligence, GPU cards without you being present or required in the lab. So let me then start with the first movie so that even people who are non-experts can get some intuition how this works, and then I'm going to decode what you see in the movie. So what I'm doing right now here, I have a domain. You can see first domain. Here is the second domain. And let me run it again. From the beginning. And what you see is that nothing happens here, but the only region which actually has some dynamics is the region of the domain wall. So what is happening? I'm injecting unpolarized electrons from the left. They eventually get spin polarized in the direction of white arrows, which are my localized magnetic moments. And then somehow these electrons, which should be blue arrow in this illustration here, which are spin polarized in the direction of the domain's magnetization, are causing the spins within the domain wall region to perform some dynamics. So where is the dynamics coming from? This is the point at which we have to jump in quickly through a crash course on spin transfer torque, which is one of the major topics in modern second generation spintronics. So as I said in one of these introductory meetings last week, the first generation spintronics means everything is collinear, which means you either have all the spins, electronic, localized, wherever they are, parallel or antiparallel. The second generation spintronics in the jargon of the community would be non-collinear business. So the first example of this non-collinear business, predicted by theorists, by the way, for which they got Buckley Prize, Slonczewski and Berger, and then that became a big technological and experimental endeavor, is this spin valve, in which case you have two ferromagnetic layers separating by metal, or in modern guise that would be magnetic tunnel junction, in which case the orange or whatever color is there, spacer is an insulator, non-magnetic insulator. And then you create this non-collinear situation, so electron is coming in, happily getting spin polarized in the red direction, and then quantum mechanics says you cannot go through the black magnetization. Only the component which is parallel to the black magnetization can go through. So then the question is, at least in this intuitive discussion without calculating anything, what happens to this component, which is transferred to the black magnetization, and that transverse component has to be absorbed. The absorption, when you start calculating, typically happens within a thin layer around the interface, and it is some form of dephasing, not decoherence. Everything is coherent, but when you sum up over electrons coming with different k vectors, then it looks like as if things are decaying, and then decay very quickly on the scale of few nanometers away from the interface. So then that angular momentum, which is absorbed by the second ferromagnetic layer, is giving a kick to the black magnetization. And now you ask yourself, like, how I'm going to describe this kick? You could try fully quantum mechanics, and I'm going to discuss this at the very end of the talk as some kind of future direction that could be also discussed as a completely open, wide open field. Or what is being done typically today experimentally, people say, okay, let me take the kick, whatever is calculated quantum mechanically or assumed as a number, and stick it into classical micromagnetics, which means that we treat dynamics of these localized magnetic moments as vectors of fixed length, using the so-called Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation. And in that equation, you have a term which says there is going to be precession. There is another term which says there's going to be damping, trying to bring magnetization back to its easy axis. Then this torque, the kick, can be decomposed into two terms called DL, damping-like, and Filler torque, which compete with these other two vectors. And at the end of the day, you have like a Newton second law sort of motion, classical motion, which is, unless I specify initial conditions and I solve this equation with all these vectors, I cannot tell you what the motion is. And the motion can be very complicated, even chaotic, because of the fact that the equation is nonlinear. So for example, from the viewpoint of applications, you can generate 7 different motions of direct technological relevance if you succeed in doing this. Flipping the magnetization from up to down, that becomes 1-0 memory element. If you drive the current and you force it to precess, this becomes a picowatt nanoscale oscillator. And then you have all these other applications. You can also create a neuron out of it. So there's this beautiful review article about spin torque building blocks. In particular, spin torque memories have already been realized. They're just too expensive or maybe too inefficient if you want to scale them to some gigabyte range to be actually sold to general public. But since they're non-volatile, which means they keep the memory recording even after the power is switched off, and they have huge endurance, much better than any of the memories we use today in our computers or pockets, there is a huge effort by several big and small players in the corporate world who are trying to bring bigger and more efficient magnetic random access memories with the prefix STT, which is spin transfer torque MRAM. So this is now a one-slide crash course on micromagnetics. So how would you model, for example, the kick forcing your magnetization to have dynamics? Well, you don't have to do anything. You don't need a theorist. You download OOMF, or actually what is really now preferred by this new generation experimentalists, you download MUMAX3, which runs on these GPU cards. You can even go to Fujitsu website and get a commercial micromagnetics program, because many of these companies, they need this kind of stuff. And then you're solving this Landau-Lifshitz equation, which says that you need to have a first derivative of the magnetization, which is going to fill this M cross H precession due to some external magnetic field, or actually this H can incorporate everything, because you could derive effective field by taking derivative of the Hamiltonian over the spin. So all the internal fields, even torque, can be sticky into H if you want. Then there is a damping term called usually Gilbert form of damping term, some kind of friction. And then the torque terms in red have to be guessed by some kind of higher level theory. But once you derive them for these micromagnetics guys, that's it. They just code the solution of differential equation. And the trouble with this approach is that, for example, in the case of regular uniform precession, you only need this so-called adiabatic torque. In the case of domain walls, you need also this so-called non-adiabatic term, whatever that means. We are not going to go into details. Then if there is a spin orbit coupling, you have to derive another set of terms to pick up the extra so-called spin orbit torque, which is a subject of another talk. Then if there is any kind of topological textures, then you need to derive another set of terms. And all of these papers that I list here are actually providing this kind of insight. And these terms are very important. For example, in this micromagnetic simulation of Mark Stiles from a few years ago, if you do not have this non-adiabatic torque, then it takes finite current to move the domain wall. As soon as you kick in the adiabatic torque, non-adiabatic torque term, then you can start moving the wall with arbitrary small current. So they are very important, but they cannot be guessed, because micromagnetics is a kind of phenomenological theory. Somebody has to derive them for you, and then you can retire the theory guy, because once they know the terms, they just put them into the solvers, they solve differential equations, and the job is done. So the other thing, now we go back to the movie, that we should pay attention is that as these magnetic moments are moving due to the current, they're performing some motion. And this kind of motion is going to introduce a time-dependent field. You can actually see my very skillful postdoc I mentioned at the beginning of the talk is able to draw these trajectories, the yellow trajectories of each individual magnetic moment. So these guys which are moving are going to introduce time-dependent fields into the quantum Hamiltonian. And the first argument is that magnetic moments localized are much slower than electrons, which are very fast, and forget about this, which will be a adiabatic approximation. But it's very dangerous to stop there, because damping essentially is a kind of first term correction to this adiabatic picture. So the question is, how important is this fact that motion of these guys is going to start jerking the electrons, which are initially static?
Good question.
Yes?
We actually know from this derivations of these additional terms, the size of them, they are in the magnitude?
Yeah, of course. So, well, that would depend. For example, the talk I gave at Riverside on Friday on this different topic is, how do we take DFT Hamiltonian, which is what Garrett says black box, but we only take Hamiltonian, and then we shuffle it through quantum transport theory to tell you what is the magnitude of torque in a specific system. So it would depend on materials. So it would depend on materials, it would depend on geometry, it would depend on the interface, which material is joining the other one, and so on. I believe
and
that
the DFT as well.
I believe that in micromagnetics they just say this is the term, and then they play, you know, let's set this value and see what happens, because there is no any kind of input that they would know in advance what is the torque for a given geometry. Torque has to be calculated quantum mechanically, but once I tell you the number and angular dependence, which is trivial in the case of spin transfer torque and much more complicated in the case of spin orbit torques, then you can do whatever you want. You don't need me anymore. You just take this table of numbers, or I can provide actually a mathematical expression by expanding function in terms of theta phi angles on the unit sphere, and that's it. You just take these numbers and you run your micromagnetics without me being present. So here is a simplest example of what happens even if the dynamics is infinitely slow, if you have dynamics of localized magnetic moments in the presence of these conduction electrons. So the example I actually concocted for several purposes, one is teaching, the other one is to test incoming graduate students, so if they can solve this problem, they can remain in the group, if not, they have to say farewell, is take the 1D tight binding chain and stick one single precessing localized magnetic moment on the chain. And so then the question is, what will happen to this? It's very difficult to answer this question. I don't know, maybe somebody has better intuition than me, because when we study quantum mechanics in our undergraduate, graduate school, they always tell you this is the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, but then we are going to switch to time-independent one. And then you never really solve any serious time-dependent problems unless you take a course, let's say, in computational physics. Luckily, in this case, there is a trick that appears in many different subfields of physics, which is you write this 1D tight-binding chain Hamiltonian with the time-dependent precession. This is just a steady-state precession, fixed externally, to be precession with some cone angle, as you see on the illustration. And then you rotate, which means you perform unit transformation to go into the rotating frame. So once you rotate, you freeze this precession to some fixed direction, just like at angle theta. But then you pop up, due to this time-dependent term from Schrödinger equation, extra Zeeman splitting term, which acts through the whole system. So effectively, what happens in the rotating frame, you have mapped your time-dependent quantum mechanical problem to a time-independent one with four electrodes, which are half-metallic ferromagnets. And now you see, and what used to be frequency of precession is now bias voltage between these four electrodes. And so now you see what will happen. The spin down from the higher electrochemical potential, we like to go to the lower electrochemical potential as a spin up. This guy would like to go in this direction, so that's a pure spin current pumping, exactly reproducing in this physical picture what Garrett, Yaroslav, and Arne predicted in 2002, I believe, as a spin pumping phenomenon, except that in their case, they get pretty much exactly the same result using the so-called scattering theory here, and kind of trying to eventually switch to scattering theory while providing some physical picture that you can have if you move in the rotating frame and rotates together with magnetization. There is also this spin current, which is spin down coming from the this lead into the up lead. Of course, you could ask, if the spin down comes here, for example, then it will never enter to this guy, because quantum mechanics says that this probability at probability is equal to zero. But of course, if the magnetization is tilted, which is why you need a finite angle theta here, the cone angle of precession, then this guy is not eigenstate of magnetization in this direction, is going to precess, and when it arrives at this interface, it's going to be in some position here, and then qualitatively, this is the transmission probability eventually to go in. Of course, if you want to get exact numbers, you would have to compute Lander-Boutica transmission coefficients. For example, this one is to start from right down, going to left up, then you have left down, right up, then you have two times left up down, and that gives you spin current. The difference between these two transmissions gives you charge current. In this case, if everything is perfectly symmetric, there is no charge current. There's only spin current, and I'm going to explain in a moment what will happen if you make it asymmetric. So then you can actually derive the formula with Mathematica. This is a very simple 2x2 algebra. And what you find out is that current is proportional to h omega, which is why we call this adiabatic spin pumping. It's proportional to sine squared theta and some parameters of this 1D tight binding chain. In other words, the formula is exactly the same as the one that you find in Garrett's Reviews of Modern Physics 2005. Yes?
I got a little lost. So is the problem is to calculate this scattering matrix for electrons in this system in the presence of the processing like impurity spin or?
Well, if you are doing the scattering matrices that Garrett used in this RMP2005, that's what you would be doing. If you're doing things in rotating frame, nothing is processing in the rotating frame. Everything is frozen. So in the rotating frame, you freeze the magnetization at some direction specified by the same angle theta, and then you calculate standard static Lander-Boutikin transmission coefficients, which is just one part of the total scattering matrix. So in the rotating frame, I have mapped the original time-dependent problems to a DC transport problem, but with four electrodes. So that's what I'm doing. So in the rotating frame, everything looks like Data's green book, for example, from, I don't know, 1990-something, where you do purely time-independent quantum transport theory. And so, as I said, if you evaluate those expressions on the previous slide, you will see that there is an equal, identical spin current pumped in both directions. I'm using here the two different x-axes so that you see plus plus sign. So the and spin current does not have to be conserved. That's why it's the same current flowing both into the left and the right direction. And they're completely identical. Now I introduce a potential barrier just for fun. And what happens is that, obviously, the right current is going to be suppressed as I increase the height of the potential barrier. Naively, you would say, if you do not calculate, I'm going to get twice the spin current to the left from what it used to be, because there was one unit of current this way, one unit that way. I'm blocking this one, so that's 1 plus 1, 2. But actually, you get four times, which shows that you have to shut up and calculate because of the fact that there is some quantum interference, in fact, which makes this number 4 rather than 2 that you would naively guess. Moreover, and interestingly enough, this is something which is beyond standard adiabatic pumping theory. As you make the system left-right symmetric, you're also going to get charge pumping from the same processing spin, but this guy is going to be proportional to omega squared rather than omega, so it's a non-adiabatic pumping at low frequency. So at this point, since there was discussion last week, it is useful to take a look at some general rules because they would appear over and over again through the talk. What is the rule to get non-zero charge pumping from a quantum system driven by time-dependent field? So it has been known since 1990s, and there is this experiment that eventually is considered now to be not really a solid proof because of various artifactual effects. There was also perspective written by Leon Glassman on it, in which case you have a quantum dot with two potentials, which are changing in time harmonically, and they're out of phase, and then they say you're going to get charge pumping with a DC component in the absence of any bias voltage. Then there was this old paper from Soviet literature, it's really Soviet physics, JTP, which says that even with one parameter changing in time harmonically, you could get charge pumping if some symmetries are broken, but they tell you here that this would be omega to the minus 1/2 power dependence of that current. And then there are interests of people interested in photovoltaics. If you apply light, as I have in this illustration, onto some system, which is not p-n junction of conventional solar cells that you see all around the campus here, for example, nicely installed on all garages, there is an environmentally friendly campus. Then the question is, can you pick up arbitrary material, shoot light, which is again time-dependent field, acting in the hoppings once you do power substitution, and get a non-zero charge current as something useful out of it. And since there is a lot of confusion in the literature, like what are these rules, even though they have been spelled out clearly in some other papers, we just decided let's pick up a bunch of simple examples and check one by one what do you get. So for example, if I take some 1D time binding chain called Rice-Mellin model that was also mentioned in some of the previous talks, and I shine and I take two static, I take two on-site potentials which are changing in time with a phase difference, then I do get charge current proportional to omega. If I take the same inversion symmetry broken chain, mimicking inversion symmetry broken material, but I apply only one parameter with cosine omega t and not a second one with some phase difference, then I get omega squared, which is this non-adiabatic pumping. If I just take inversion symmetric material, but I make left and right lead to be different, then I also get omega squared. And if I get light, I also get omega squared. So the rule is as was on the previous slide, I have to break left-right symmetry statically. If I do that, I will get pumping proportional to omega squared, which is non-adiabatic pumping. If I break left-side symmetry dynamically by time-dependent potentials, then I'm going to get what you see here, which is current proportional to omega. And this is going to kind of follow us until the end of the talk. So what do we really calculate to model all the systems in addition to using classical LLG equation for the dynamics of localized magnetic moments? Well, we use the time-dependent non-equilibrium Green function formalism. The formalism has two fundamental objects with easy physical interpretation. The retarded Green function gives you available quantum states. For example, in equilibrium, you have to have density of states given by this retarded Green function. And then the filling of those states is given in equilibrium simply by Fermi distribution function. Pay attention when we teach kids quantum mechanics in various courses. We tell them you establish connection between quantum mechanics and what is being measured by computing expectation values, but this, of course, is useless for research because it doesn't have temperature, it doesn't know that you're applying bias voltage, time-dependent fields. If you want to do anything at finite temperature or out of equilibrium, you have to switch to quantum statistical mechanics, and the fundamental object of any quantum statistical mechanics is non-equilibrium or equilibrium density matrix. So if I take standard textbook equilibrium density matrix and I rewrite it in terms of Green functions, then I get this expression. This is actually grand canonical equilibrium density matrix from any textbook quantum statistical mechanics. But I also need to apply bias voltages, for example, and create a steady state current situation. In that case, the filling factor cannot be Fermi distribution function or any other distribution function because we don't know what is the magic representation in which this density matrix is diagonal. That's why we work in arbitrary representation, and the filling of the states is now replaced by the so-called G Lesser function. So this is really the physical interpretation of these two Keldysh functions. And if you have this non-equilibrium density matrix in steady state, then you can calculate the spin transfer torque and the steady state current. But for the purpose of this talk, we will need time-dependent non-equilibrium density matrix. And that object is obtained by taking G Lesser at equal times, TT. So you can actually solve some equations. In this case, it's a matrix integral differential equation for this object, which looks like standard von Neumann equation, if there was only this left side term and first right hand side term. But because all of the devices that we are going to consider are attached to macroscopic reservoirs, which fundamentally very important for any non-equilibrium quantum statistical mechanics, introduce continuous spectrum into the game, fermionic reservoirs, then you have this extra term which makes it so-called quantum master equation, but this master equation is actually exact in this case, as long as you don't have some inelastic and many-body process, which I'm going to discuss briefly at the end of the talk. And then you have to solve this equation. Interestingly enough, these kind of equations have been solved initially or originally in 1994 by two people who are here in the KITP, but I saw them today. They like to attend biological talks these days more often than this hard quantum solid state talk. So Meyer Wingren and Eagle Meyer and Ned Wingren did try to solve these equations in 1994 in a famous and highly cited papers, but they were stuck at that time due to various technical reasons, both trying to paper pencil, whatever, computers were not that good, at just two sites, if you want. And they were doing all kinds of so-called wideband limit approximations and so on. So it took another two decades in 2014 to actually realize how to solve these equations efficiently. Efficiently in this case means that if you're stuck with these matrices, and these matrices have two spatial indices, and then time is another index, it's like a four-dimensional matrix, then any kind of attempt to solve this by brute force on the computer leads to so-called computational complexity, which is O of delta t to the cube. And then you are stuck to simulate things on the scale of 10 or less femtoseconds. If you want to reach spintronic scales, which is nanoseconds, you have to reduce the complexity to just linear. And those algorithms became kind of understood only in 2014, which is why nobody was doing this for anything realistic more than few sites or trying to simulate to nanosecond scales and so on. Yes, please.
Is this an interacting, electrons are interacting or not? Is this kinetic equation?
This equation here is derived for single electrons which interact eventually with this classically treated localized magnetic moments. But it's exact because they do not interact with other electrons or, let's say, with magnets. As I said, at the very end of the talk, I'm going to revisit that question. What would happen if you want to treat full many-body interactions that are in Fock space and you only fold them down into some kind of a single particle space by playing with Green functions? So in other words...
Sorry, so this is a just Boltzmann equation?
No, this is a master equation. It's like if I had just this term here, the one which I circle here, that would be standard von Neumann equation for any kind of quantum system which is closed, commutator or Hamiltonian, and the density matrix. Since this quantum system is attached to macroscopic reservoirs, I get this extra term. Like people who, for example, do this biological program here, many of them solve this kind of equations, but they put this extra term by hand. Steven Weinberg, by the way, he has given up on writing papers in high energy physics, but you can see him authoring one after another papers in PhysRev A. And they're all about solving these kind of equations with the right-hand side term provided as in so-called Lindblad form, which means you guess it terminologically. In my case, these P matrices are actually derived exactly once they start from some given quantum Hamiltonian of something attached to semi-infinite leads, macroscopic Fermi liquid reservoirs, and so on. And it turns out that these abstract P objects are the path to get the current. So if you know these P matrices, you get immediately what is the current flowing, charge current flowing to lead P, or what is the spin current. Of course, according to this basic equation, if you want to get, for example, a non-equilibrium spin density, you just take trace of this non-equilibrium density matrix, multiply that with the Pauli matrix, and that is going to be this S guy. And you also have to subtract any joint from equilibrium. This is why I mentioned this equilibrium matrix, so the proper equation is the one in yellow. Once you have this quantum calculated, time-dependent, non-equilibrium spin density, this is like just the kind of definitions, if you cross-product that with this classical localized magnetic moment, that will give you local torque. And then you have everything to go back and start solving Lambda-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation with microscopically derived spin torques.
Sorry, just a question.
Yes.
What's sigma?
A vector of Pauli matrices.
No.
Oh, the capital sigma. This is the lesser self-energy generated by the semi-infinite lead or like Fermi liquid reservoir, if you want. So because I'm attaching the finite size physical system to something infinite, then the sigma pops up in these equations.
So it has a closed form.
Yeah. It has a, this is excellent point. So like, it has a closed form, but it's very difficult to run that closed form at every time step. So there are all kinds of tricks to rewrite that. This is equation that they put on the paper. But what goes in the computer is something completely different. So here's a good example. Suppose I take 1,000 atoms or magnetic moments. 1,000 atoms in, let's say, world of Newton's second laws, which is molecular dynamics in chemistry, biological physics, or this Lambda-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation leads to 3,000 coupled ordinary differential equations. If you start shuffling sigma you're asking about, together with this matrix differential equation, like 1,000 quantum atoms means I put, let's say, one orbital per atom. This is a 1,000 times 1,000 if it is a chain matrix, but the number of ordinary differential equation that you actually have to solve can reach 10 million. So this is how quantum mechanics hit you, because quantum mechanics is always more complicated than classical physics, even in this case when you're just looking at non-interacting electrons, the ones which do not have. If there was any kind of interaction, by the way, that would introduce extra contribution to sigma lesser. Yeah. So any kind of many-body interaction in the world of Green function means, and this is actually what you can read, for example, in this article, which I'm going to discuss briefly at the end of the talk. This is our article where we derive what is the self-energy due to electron-magnon interaction if you want to introduce inelastic scattering.
Like an organizational remark. So we've already been here for 45 minutes, so and I don't want to run too much past the hour.
Okay.
So just to make you aware of...
Fine. So let's warm up.
John had a question.
Yeah,
but there's also questions, so like
I don't want to speed you up quickly, but just to make to make you aware of
yes, please.
From the previous slide, can you go back on one slide? So that pi that depends on the space as well, or depends on
Depends
on two.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pi is a matrix, so like.
So your density matrix depends on space. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it has every object here, like you can see them. So every object here has a spatial index. And it has time indices. So like green function by itself is a object which depends on four different discrete coordinates. Rho or P, they depend on just two discrete coordinates in real space. And the time is absorbed. I mean, it depends on one time if you want.
Sorry, can I ask? But I thought that you said that sigma basically describes the leads, which has in some sense in some dynamic limit. So what role does the coordinate play there? I think following Leon's question. Because I understand for the Green's function of whatever finite size object that you're coupling to the lead.
Well, it's the issue of where is your Hilbert space. At the end of the day, like this matrix rho, if you pick up a system of 1,000 atoms and you put one orbital per side, that's a matrix 1,000 by 1,000. So every other matrix in this equation has to be defined in the same Hilbert space. So, like, it can happen, for example, that...
But the sigma couples not just at the edge of your system where it leads is
Sigma, of course, sigma is a matrix full of zeros. And then the only non-zero element is that one. But it has to be defined in the same Hilbert space. Otherwise, you're asking to sum up matrix 1,000 by 1,000 plus 1 times 1, and that's not allowed. Yeah, you just have to put them all in the same space. And the P matrix, of course, is not going to be that simple. So sigma is simple, but P is not.
Yeah, because there's a Green function.
Yeah, it's a Green function, yeah. Okay. You can get, by the way, local currents from Rij. So local Rii gives you local charge density or spin density. Rij gives you current from atom I to atom J. So you can get anything you want from this rho and P. So just to warm up, because you don't know, like this looks like very complicated, you might be getting a lot of noise, let me reproduce that analytical formula. This is also how you should check your calculations, by taking again that single spin and precessing. So you see in the beginning, when I start precession, I get all kinds of transients, but after 400 femtoseconds for a given precession frequency, which I speed up to make it more convenient, I exactly get SZDC current and two currents changing in time. And if you look at the numbers, they exactly match the analytical formula. Good. That means I could be safe that whatever I'm now running is not going to be some terrible wrong thing. You do get sine squared theta that appears in this Garrett's RMP and in this reconstruction using this rotating frame. You also see this fact that was emphasized by Garrett and collaborators that spin pumping is always interfacial phenomenon. So you cannot get more pumping by putting more spins together because everything happens around the interface. So as you add more spins into the game, you actually get some saturation and then it goes down. So now we start first realistic example. So now to couple everything together, we start from this non-equilibrium density matrix. That gives us this non-equilibrium spin density. The spin density gives torque into the LHG equation. Then we update this micromagnetics and that guy goes back into the quantum Hamiltonian. And then the question is, what do we gain from here? So for example, when we inject current into that movie and we calculate something, we do see the domain wall is moving. We can actually visualize local torque across the domain wall at different snapshots. For example, the way to read this, this is the time, and then you have a chain of 50 atoms. What is the torque on the each localized magnetic moments along this slice? And there was an attempt to formulate something like this using steady state Green function, which is of course not allowed because steady state Green functions do not know that Hamiltonian of my quantum system at time t1 does not commute with another Hamiltonian, same Hamiltonian at time t2. So this kind of stuff is not taken into account if you try this naive, and some engineers, even in Intel, have been using this kind of NGF LLG approach. But with this approach, actually, this is taken into account. You can get pumping, torque, all kinds of effects, especially pumping, which is not present in any classical micromagnetics codes because there are no electrons in classical micromagnetics codes. Nothing flies through the system that is considered by this classical micromagnetics. So in particular, we can actually calculate how much spin current or charge current is pumped as the domain wall moves through the system being driven by the current. This is exactly that movie, but now calculated, then you see there is oscillating current. It could be converted into AC voltage via the inverse pinhole effect, which will tell you, for example, where is the position of the domain wall and so on. So then since we have this formalism, which effectively means this, you could say that what I'm doing here, I start from G lesser, and I shift, for example, to some other representation for convenience, it could be Wigner or something else, and I expand the G lesser into some terms, which is adiabatic term plus first non-adiabatic correction in the small parameter being dynamics of magnetization. And some people have been trying this, but my formalism is equivalent to taking all these terms to infinite order, because it's non-perturbative and exact. And then I say, let me check what my formalism says about some standard results. In particular, if you have these non-collinear textures, there has been this theory called spin motive force theory, which tells you that if you have non-collinear arrangement of magnetic moments changing in time, then they should pump charge current. And this was actually confirmed experimentally using domain walls. To be honest, I actually read this paper from 2009 by Rembert, and Rembert at the end of the paper, if you don't remember this, he says, like, but we should check if higher order terms than the first derivatives contribute to this result. And I said, wow. And he says, this will be the topic of subsequent publication. So I searched Dyne.
I didn't say it was my subsequent publication.
Yeah, you didn't say it. I searched Dyne, you know, drilled through Google. Google has become terrible these days for searching scientific publications, too much data science focused on buying and selling. And I can't find it. And I said, okay, let's fire this non-perturbative TD NEGF LG formalism and see what we get. So by the way, there are many people, like you could find papers by Sinova, a couple of them, when they solve these guys from micromagnetic simulations and then just feed them into this formula. And they predict all kinds of stuff based on this kind of one-way coupling when your micromagnetics supplies the input for just this formula as long as you believe the formula is correct. So we do that kind of approach and we calculate this voltage due to the spin motive force. For the specific simple case, this is always the best when you try to learn something, pick a simplest example. We pick up three spins to precess, but we make them non-collinear, because if they're collinear, this delta alpha term would be zero. And when we do that, we do actually get perfect tracking with the spin motive force formula, which breaks down at 0.1 eV. And that turns out to be relevant because the maximum speed of spin dynamics in realistic materials doesn't go beyond terahertz. And terahertz is 0.04 electron volts. So that means the spin motive force formula is perfectly valid for all relevant frequencies, gigahertz to terahertz. But then we make it more non-collinear by twisting angle, relative angle between these three spins, and then we break spin motive force formula at angle bigger than 10 degrees. So if there are any non-collinear structures, magnetic textures, when the angle between neighboring spins is more than 10 degrees, then your spin motive force formula is not valid anymore, and you have to start taking into account other derivatives. For example, Stefan Blugel from Jülich had a recent paper when they were looking at second derivative contribution to the spin motive force formula. Our formalism, again, is equivalent to taking every single possible derivative. Of course, not all of them are going to be relevant as you go to higher.
Yes. I mean, in your formalism, the system is completely clean, right? So isn't it so that like these higher order derivatives that it should not be powers of omega, but rather, let's say, omega times tau or so, with tau is some disorder scattering time, and then in real
systems. Yeah, realistic systems, yeah. Here I'm just picking up the simplest example to understand how does the spin motive force formula performs compared to, like,
yeah, but what I'm saying is this 0.1, or this tera, I would say, I mean, it will depend on.
True.
This is for a clean system.
Yeah,
I'm doing the system. You may never reach it somehow.
Of course, I'm just doing. Yeah, I'm doing here like the simplest example, just to check. In real systems, yeah, if I put this order, the breaking could be like at.
I would think somehow that it's as hard as driving. Or okay, you know,
yeah.
It's kind of as unlikely as getting second, how do you say, quadratic corrections to Ohm's law and so on. So you really have to drive.
So what I'm saying, any deviation of this type is irrelevant. It's too high in frequency. It's just unrealistic. I just kind of by brute force am trying to understand how I can break this analytical formula by solving everything exactly. Here is another example which is far more important practically. So as you remember, this racetrack memory is required to fire the pulse eventually into the magnetic nanowire, move the domain wall, and know exactly where the domain wall is. And that's what I'm doing here. You see, there is a first pulse coming in, domain wall moves, then the second pulse has opposite voltage, domain wall moves back. If I have full control, which is the essence of operating that racetrack memory, over the position of magnetic domain wall, then I should bring it back to the same position. Nevertheless, in the literature, especially people who do pure micromagnetics, they have concluded that there is something called inertial motion of a domain wall. And it looks terrible because they divide the size of that inertial motion by the Gilbert damping. This parameter lambda is dimensionless, typically 0.01 in realistic ferromagnetic wires. W is the width of the wall, which is 3 lattice spacings, for example, in my case. And delta phi is the angle. In my case, that's P. And so when you put this formula together, it looks like you should get hundreds of lattice spacings of uncontrolled motion of domain wall after the pulse has stopped. On the other hand, my result shows that I only get 2. And when I saw this, I was really afraid to publish this paper because it looks like I'm going against theory that was established in 2007 and people have been copying and pasting this result. I then saw that experimentalists did find in Japan, Kyoto University, much smaller inertial motion, and that gives a confidence maybe there is something going on that would be compatible with our theory. In particular, their micromagnetics was producing huge motion of the wall after all currents had stopped, and they tried to explain this by doing what Rembert said, let's put this order, cramp some pinning centers and so on. So in other words, it looks like that our formalism is providing different dynamics by creating more damping compared to anything you see in micromagnetics. And by the way, confirmation of that comes from this alternative analytical theory done for this collective coordinates in which they talk about massive domain walls. So everything in this paper is exactly compatible with what we see, which is that in the presence of conduction electrons moving around. And by the way, you can see what happens if you follow all these pictures that you were trying to gain intuitively through the movies. Like you drive the domain wall, the magnetic moment starts pumping. It is pumping left-right. The pumping hits another magnetic domain. It drives electrons. So they all start pumping into each other. And you get a very complicated self-consistent non-equilibrium state, which has to be solved exactly. So,
but I mean, that is still, I believe you for a clean system, but does the experiment have anything to do with the clean system? So I think the small parameter.
Well, so the point of our paper, or this one by Victor and Hilary and Tero, all of three who have come here, is that even if everything is clean, you would actually get this substantial increase effectively of the mass of the domain wall due to these processes when spins are pumping into each other and you're getting new effects. And I'm going to discuss them a little bit.
So I think these effects are kind of probably small in either omega tau or KFL or so.
Well, the trick is that they are not small. That's the point. Like, otherwise, you
how
know.
How do you know if your theory doesn't have, like,
I can easily put this order, but let me first understand without this order. So, like, what I'm saying is that when I saw this, I was thinking something is wrong with my theory, and I should also put this order. Mm-hmm. What I started doing, I said, let me crank up lambda, and I saw that everything is insensitive to lambda. And then comes the next slide. Then we can go back to this order, like, to make it more realistic. So if you actually start from this theory, which is sort of exact, as long as you believe to quantum classical dynamics of this type.
And as long as you neglect electron-electron interactions.
Sure. And if you now try to derive the equation for spin, which has been done by many people, there is a paper from 2006 by Nagaosan, where he talks about Vesumino model to derive effective equation for spin in the presence of conduction electrons. There is another one by Rembert and Nunez, when they consider single spin connected to two leads and derive this kind of equations. So if you start to look, what is the effective equation that our spin is experiencing due to this Keldysh business of electrons moving back and forth, pumping, torques, and stuff like that, you actually end up, and this is only valid in the limit of weak electron localized spin interaction, or weak coupling to these macroscopic reservoirs, you end up with non-Markovian LLG equation. So the only difference between my non-Markovian LLG equation and the one derived by Nagaosa-Rembert is that this is now derived and it works for many more spins than just one or two in the case of Nagaosa they considered. if I approximate it further in the case of slow dynamics, I do recover standard LLG equation, but my LLG equation has all parameters being time dependent, and it also picks up things like inertia, which is the second derivative of M. That would be important if dynamics is really fast. And so what is the physical mechanism of introduction of the so-called time retardation? Well, the physical mechanism is what you see here. As you crank up this coupling between moving electrons and local spins, the electron spin can never follow instantaneously what the local spin is doing. So there is always a lag, and that lag becomes torque. So this is a sort of new source of damping that is not in any of these torque formulas, scattering formula of Gilbert damping, which comes from spin orbit coupling and phonons. And some people in the micromagnetics community have been trying to play with this equation, but they have been deriving these terms phrenologically. They say, let's assume that the kernel of this retardation is e to the minus t, blah, blah, blah. Here they all come from quantum mechanics. So the Kedrgeous formalism fixes the form of these retarded kernels. And if I start checking out how does this look like, I can actually get, for example, this notation is a result of this inertia. I can see inhomogeneous damping due to the presence of these moving electrons. And if I compare purely micromagnetic simulation of domain wall motion driven by magnetic fields, so I don't have current, like I cannot inject current into micromagnetics. So I pick example, again, simplest one, in which I can do pure micromagnetic simulation. For example, domain wall moved by magnetic field, we discussed in one of the very early slides, and I get this motion. Then I allow electrons to go in with this full quantum classical coupling, and I get completely different motion. So like there is something missing. Typically, all the effects which come through this time retardation point out to a damping which is 10 times, one order of magnitude bigger than anything you plug in by putting that lambda m cross vm over dt. So that's the answer to this question of how important is this. Now, of course,
I believe it's important when the system is clean, but I don't believe it's important when the system is dirty.
Well, okay. There are two completely different things. Like, you could have this stuff being killed if the system is dirty, but there is still pumping out, for example. And pumping out, you cannot kill because pumping just goes into the lid. So there are like several. So let me explain what this thing really does. So it picks up three different things. It picks up any torque without you having to guess analytical expression for spin torque, because any torque is trace of rho of T sigma cross M, without you writing this adiabatic, non-adiabatic term spin orbit. Everything is picked up automatically. So that's one benefit. Second benefit, it picks up any spin current pumping out of the system, which is going to be there even if you put a lot of disorder inside the system. And then the third benefit is introduces this time-retarded damping effects, which are completely independent, an additional source of damping on the top of anything that you would get from Kambersky torque formula and so on. So now, how important is this third effect for disorder system? This is something we did not really answer because we looked at this simple example, same as Victor, like looking at this massive domain wall. And we're going to look at this. But even if you kill that by plugging in disorder, you don't kill these other two things, that you get any torque you want, and you get pumping out of the system or into the system. Because effectively,
but I would still think that pumping out of the system is only kind of relevant for mesoscopic size system, right? For bulk systems, long
Well,
waves.
Okay, yeah, bulk. So there was an excellent thing.
System, so yeah. I'm not saying.
Let me tell you this. There was an excellent question of this type, challenging Garrett. Maybe he doesn't remember, but I have a good memory. It's 2005, hot and humid summer, Mushiatsui in Japanese. In what's the name of the island just off the coast of Osaka or Awajishima?
Right.
And Gerrits in 2005, like very fresh, gives a talk on spin pumping. And he says, I'm using mesoscopic theory of spin pumping, it's all quantum. And this was like a room, I think there was a 200 students, huge room. And one student raises a hand and asks, Gerrits, you're using quantum mechanics for something which is room temperature. You're using quantum transport for something with room temperature, which is kind of this argument. We don't need to take this into account. And Garrett says, and that's why I remember it, because it kind of gives us the boost to continue doing this, he says, but this is all interface. And so the point is that anything mesoscopic or quantum transport will be killed at room temperature by diffusing lines. But since pumping happens around the interface, that area which pumps or creates torque is always shorter scale than anything that diffusing does.
I believe
and
you.
So this is why.
Like a long wire, let's say several micrometers, and here I have my domain wall, it's moving, it will pump, but then the leads that I attach to this several micrometer long wire don't matter somehow. I mean, well, it's true that there is current and spin current going there, perhaps, if the domain wall gets closed.
Yeah.
But I think the spin pumping at an interface is very different somehow. And there you have like a very sharp interface.
Yeah, I'm going to show you an example when domain wall disappears and there's a spin wave, completely classical spin wave. This classical spin wave will hit the interface, and then what do? There's no micromagnetics which is going to tell you how the classical spin wave being stopped at the interface is going to do something, jerk electrons.
So let me just take a step back. I don't have a problem with anything of what you're saying, but it's somehow, I think there are a lot of cases where somehow these extra things like this huge non-adiabatic effects, the effect of interfaces, spin currents leaking out into etc., don't play a role, I think. So many of the things that experimenters do in terms of simulating moving domain walls, I think it's fully adiabatic. Because the systems are very dirty.
But again,
at the electronic level, are very dirty.
Any experimentalist in the field of this spin pumping, spin torque would create this kind of heterostructure, ferromagnet normal metal at room temperature. So are you saying that if you start processing this F, you don't have to worry about spin current?
No, I'm saying
that's a Garrett's theory of enhanced Gilbert dumping.
Let's say standard micromagnetics where you have looking at domain walls, skirmions, etc. So unless these systems are extremely clean, so in MNSI actually these non-adiabatic corrections have been seen because somehow then the pumped current leads to ohmic heating, etc. The system is clean and these corrections are important. But somehow what I'm saying is there are kind of many systems where it's not so relevant, and so there should be kind of small parameters that tell you which...
Sure, but again, I explained that there are three completely different things. You're focusing just on dumping. Like, again, take a look at this experiment. They run the experiment and they see the numbers. Then there are micromagnetics and there is discrepancy factor 100. And then they start cramming this order like crazy to bring those numbers down to what is experimental by adding pinning centers, impurities and stuff like that. What I'm saying is that us or Victor see that you can get exactly what they see experimentally even when there are no impurities. I mean,
doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't mean anything.
What KFL is for your...
But okay, so let me explain again. There are three things that this thing picks up. You could kind of argue, oh, this is irrelevant. It picks up torque of any form without you having to derive this expression. It picks up spin pumping out of the system into the leads, which does happen at room temperature. This is actually one of the major differences between this adiabatic pumping attempted by mesoscopic community in 1990s. Anything they did was like either low temperature full of artifacts. On the other hand, spin pumping is ubiquitous phenomenon. Everybody sees spin pumping. And it has to be taken into account because it's an additional source of dumping. Here you could say that I'm pumping locally and moving spins around as I have no clean texture. So I have a spin pumping, I have any torque, and I have this third effect where everything comes into account. If you put this order, you would kill, for example, maybe this retarded dumping. But I don't see like how you are going to move away, like, you know, Beach did detect spin pumping.
Yeah, but I mean, there is spin pumping by an interface, right? This spin pumping by moving the...
But there is nothing like a spin pumping by interface in any micromagnetics.
Well, that's my point.
Yeah.
So the leads don't matter then. Right, so you agree with me.
What do you mean?
Well, so if there's no interface, somehow the lead in the system is large compared to, let's say, any mean-free part or so, kind of that you attach it to lead doesn't matter. Just like an ordinary...
It matters if you try to detect something. So like you can see...
You can see papers, for example, by
Yaroslav when he says, oh, I would really like to calculate spin current, but I can't because there's nothing like that in the micromagnetic scopes. So like as I'm telling you, in the case of Beach, whatever he generates in this annihilation I'm going to look at the moment gets stopped at the non-magnetic magnetic interface.
I believe that, but that's fine.
And then there is a signal. How would you calculate that signal? You could start writing some phenomenological equations like
maybe
G up, down.
Please continue just to talk.
We can discuss, further. So,
can you wrap up in, let's say, 5 to 10 minutes
at most? Yeah. So let me wrap up. So let's look at this most interesting case because it's experimental. So the goal is like, okay, can we reproduce what is experimentally? And indeed, we start at equals to 0 with 2 magnetic domain walls with plus minus topological charge. After 645 femtoseconds, which we do to kind of speed up by putting a large magnetic field, we line them up. That's it. Annihilation completed. At the moment of annihilation, you see what is being generated, spin wave. A beautiful spin wave, exactly as expected and seen experimentally, but indirectly. I can actually look at the whole movie of this process. So I start with 2 magnetic domain walls, first, second one. I apply a magnetic field in this direction. They're precessing, hitting each other, monitor what the orange curve does, which is the Z component of localized magnetic moments. So when the Z component becomes parallel to the x-axis, when the x component in this case, because we're looking at the domain walls with respect to x-axis as easy axis, when it becomes parallel, that's it. Now they have annihilated, but this is what you have as a remnant. So this is an example of a spin wave. So like, pay attention. Sometimes people say I have magnon. So magnon is only this. Everything before that was very violent magnetization dynamics. There is a recent paper by Stuart Parkin when he sees violent magnetization dynamics due to femtosecond pulse. So this is not magnon, whatever you were watching before that. Only this thing is magnon. A precession around easy axis with some angle of less than 10 degrees. It's like a low energy excitation. But there are many higher order excitations that can be much more complicated than magnon. So what is the stuff that we pick up here that was not picked up by Beach? Well, this is it. It's a pumping out of the system of spin current. So now the question is, you say, like, say, well, this is irrelevant. Because who cares? But the Beach eventually takes this spin current and he tries to detect it as the example of spin wave generation. So eventually, when the spin wave travels and reaches this interface to the normal metal, it's going to be stopped because there are no magnetic moments on the right hand side. It's going to bounce. As it is stopped, it is going to excite first, it's going to start pumping, exactly as Garrett explains in this viewpoint. And that pumping would eventually convert current carried by spin waves into current carried by electrons. And if you look at the Fourier transform of this pumping, it's a broadband pumping. So there is no analytical formula which has anything like this. All the analytical formulas that tell you that pumping is only at one frequency. So there's a broadband pumping in the whole process, and the spin current is flowing through the whole system as these two domain walls try to annihilate each other. If I compare the electronic spin current, which is the gray guy, with respect to pure spin wave spin current, they are both contributions at the same time, which means once you do what Beach did experimentally, convert now this electronic spin current into inverse spin hole voltage, you're going to get the signals, and they are not coming purely from your spin wave business. If you now look, for example, at these dynamics with zero standard Gilbert damping or non-zero standard Gilbert damping, there is not much difference. So this shows that at least in this clean system I am considering, everything comes from this retarded damping. And then if I look at the Fourier spectrum of the waves being generated, I get a huge difference between classical micromagnetics alone and my quantum mechanics classical micromagnetics here. And so this is again the issue, how important would this be in realistic samples. But this is the second effect. I pick up a current pumped out of the system, which can never be done by any formula or any micromagnetics. And I pick up this effect for the spin currents pumped into the system, which is this retarded Gilbert damping.
But is this somehow a metal that ends and then there's platinum at one end? Or how does it, what is the precise setup of the...
The setup is what you see here. So there is a magnetic nanowire.
I mean the experimental setup. Yeah. Or is this the experimental?
Well, he put platinum.
But on an insulator or is it a metal?
No, it's all metal. Uh-huh. But he puts platinum so that whatever spin wave is doing is eventually converted into electronic motion in platinum, which does not have a magnetic moment, except maybe at the interface due to proximity effect. So here is actually this two unpublished stuff that I'm trying to finalize here. So I was wondering, you know, because of intricacies of doing everything quantum mechanical, what would happen if I just put a spin wave and start pushing electrons through a spin wave? Spin wave, again, being this simplest possible excitations when all magnetic moments precess with some phase and some angle 10 degrees. And first thing I pick up is that if I just put the uniform mode, I just reproduce the standard result to warm up, which is left-right current identical. If I now put a spin wave, I get different left and right spin current, which is something expected because of spin current carried by the spin wave. But I also get charge pumping from the spin wave alone. So pay attention. This is a standard experiment done by hundreds of people in the spintronics community. You take a ferromagnetic metal, you expose it to microwaves, you process uniformly, you get current pump left-right. But I'm saying here, if you excite non-uniform mode, which is a spin wave, then you get charge pumping. I look in the literature, has anybody discussed this? Maybe Garrett knows better than me, and I find only two papers. There is a paper by Arne Brandt of charge pumping by magnons, magnonic charge pumping nature something, and there is a PRB in which they took Yig, put on graphene, and they see chiral charge pumping, but in this case, essentially what Yig does, it introduces magnetic ordering into graphene, and then graphene really pumps because Yig is not conducting. In any case, in both of these cases, spin orbit coupling is crucial. Without spin orbit coupling, you get zero result. In my case,
like an insulator on top of a
metal. No. This is a metallic ferromagnetic wire attached to two electrodes, and I excite a spin wave inside that wire. If I excite uniform mode inside that wire, I get this. Just charge current left, right, same as Garrett's RMP 2005 or this single processing moment and so on. If I now make the mode non-uniform with a non-zero K, which means I create a spin wave, I get this charge current. Where is the charge current coming from? That's what they try. That is what I was trying to sell you about the symmetry breaking. So if you look at the spin wave and you put a plane halfway at the spin wave, that's exactly dynamical symmetry breaking because left part of the device is not identical to the right one because there is a wave. So this exactly confirms, and if I look at the frequency dependence, I do get proportional to omega. So it's completely compatible with the general rules I gave you. If you break the symmetry statically, you get omega square pumping at low frequency. If you break the symmetry dynamically, you get omega proportional pumping. Then I can inject electrons into the spin wave itself, and I can look how do these electrons reflect, scatter, or whatever they do. Like, for example, Paul Kelly has this formalism when he tries to inject electrons into static frozen spin wave to understand the resistance due to the presence of randomized magnetic moments. Here you can see what is the full picture of full time-dependent spin wave because of using time-dependent quantum transportive. This is another example that we are now exploring, also unpublished. Here I'm injecting the object called Leviton, which is something Leonid Levitov created 10, 20 years ago to figure out what is the way to excite single electron out of the Fermi C. Eventually, it has to be this Lorentzian pulse. I'm injecting a Lorentzian current pulse onto the ferromagnetic insulator. This guy bounces back because it cannot go through. There is no conduction in the ferromagnetic insulator. And then you can see that spin wave again is excited in the insulator, and that insulator now starts pumping into the right lead, and whatever that is pumped is calculated exactly. So now you could say, you know, in this case, you don't even have to worry about any damping effects, but this is a non-trivial effect you have also been studying in different formalisms. So now we are picking it up microscopically without doing any fudging. Everything is done simply by shuffling two Hamiltonians as the input of the whole calculation. So finally, why not do everything quantum mechanically? Yes?
If I understand correctly, you excite one magnon via the Leviton process? You will excite single magnon because of this, or what?
Yeah, so you excite what you see here.
But is it single magnon? Like, would it have to be one?
Well, you know, single magnon, it's a tricky issue. Like, I was just interviewing 2 days ago a bunch of people applying for job, and they talk about quantum magnonics. So, like, this is a single spin wave, but how many quanta of energy are there? That's a single magnon. So, a single magnon will be some kind of quantum limit. This is a classical spin wave, and if you want to see what is being excited, we do Fourier transform on this stuff. If you see one frequency, that's then a single magnon. If you see more than one, that means there is more than one magnon being excited. So in any case, these guys are excited, this guy processes, and that pumps then charge and spin current, and you can see what is being pumped into. You could also inject like spin precession, laser light, all kinds of stuff. So in any case, so here is the conclude. This is actually the very last slide, and then we are done. So this is the issue of why not treat everything quantum mechanically. That was the question people ask, why not include many-body interactions and so on. And you can do this by full Kelder diagrammatics, constructing yourself energies, but it becomes very tricky because you have to map spins to bosons. There are many ways to map. Some of them are not really precise. The other issue is that you're cherry-picking diagrams, and there are all kinds of mathematical tricks there that you could be making terrible mistakes. Eventually, magnons have a small bandwidth. So like whatever you do to electrons is a weak correlation, but since magnon has a small bandwidth, what matters is that interaction between electron and magnon divided by the bandwidth, and that can be a large number. And then magnons feel this interaction strongly correlated, which means you have to go far beyond these Hartree-Fock diagrams, as we discussed in this paper, by finding quasi-bound states of magnons surrounded by electron-hole pairs. So one other reason to look at fully quantum dynamics is actually this recent experiment of the so-called quantum spin torque, which I kind of advertised as a possible topic for discussion. There are only three theory papers trying to explain this, which is by Arne, Rembert, and us. And in this quantum spin torque, in a spin valve at 1 Kelvin, so now comes like fundamental physics as opposed to applied spintronics, they inject current into the spin valve, which is completely collinear, and standard classical theory of Slonczewski-Berger tells you there is nothing there because cross product is zero, but in experiment they see something moving. So there is a magnetization dynamics due to flow of current in a perfectly collinear geometry. When I showed this to Dan Ralph, he said, we must have seen this because we have been doing this for decades. And then he pulls out a paper of Slonczewski from mid-2000s. In that paper, they do see current inducing some kind of dynamics, and there is a change in conductance of the junction as you increase the voltage. But in that example, conductance or current increases because you open new channels via inelastic scattering. In this example, it decreases. It's a completely opposite behavior. So eventually, then you ask yourself, like, what is the fully quantum picture of torque? Since everything here must be treated quantum mechanically, you have to treat electron quantum mechanically, you have to treat spins quantum mechanically. The reason why this is so difficult, because if you put 10 spins, that's 2 to the 10 Hilbert space, and then it grows very quickly and becomes intractable by any brute force calculations. The fundamental thing is that in quantum mechanics, there is no spin in this direction, spin this direction, and so on. There is only this. If you say I'm injecting X spin, you're really injecting 1 over square root of 2 up plus down. And then you can ask yourself, what do these guys individually do? Eventually, it turns out that all of this quantum spin torque can be understood as the down electron initiated dynamics of a full many-body system. And so what really happens if you inject up spin electron, then you have this kind of state, up times up, 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 locally. So this is electronic one, this is locally spins, and this guy doesn't change in time because it's an eigenstate of the many-body Hamiltonian. But if you inject down spin electron, as would be the case of this fully collinear geometry, or anything in any other direction because of this superposition of up and down states, what you're going to see is that now many-body system evolves. And as it evolves, quantum mechanics likes to branch out into every possibility. Every many-body quantum state compatible with conservation of angular momentum is going to be excited with some coefficients. The reason why you cannot discuss this in some scandaling fashion, but you go back and shut up and calculate, is that human being doesn't know what are the coefficients in this superposition. And they're very strange when you look at them for the first time. So what you're really creating is what people in quantum information science would be calling entangled state. If you now switch to density matrices again to find states of individual spins, you're going to find that, let's say, first localized spin has a density matrix, if it is 1/2, 1/2, 1 plus p sigma, and this p vector is becoming less than 1. Less than 1 means decoherence. So this is exactly the condition that is not allowed in any kind of LLG dynamics, because Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation is valid as long as S is very large, H bar can be taken to 0, S cross H is 1, and all the states are separable in the language of many-body quantum mechanics. In this case, you're getting non-separable many body quantum states. When you start tracing and getting these guys, this p is getting less than 1, which is what you see here. So there is a perfect example of decoherence due to entanglement to a much bigger environment. And this is our explanation of what is causing dynamics in that Urajdin experiment. So one thing you cannot do with the simplistic picture that provided in this paper is you cannot know what would happen if you inject million of electrons into million of local spins. So for that purpose, we are actually just now developing a new formalism, a sort of spintronics meets TDD MRG, which is powerful because you don't have to worry about this mapping to bosonic particles and so on, but you're stuck in 1D. So here is again the movie to finish. This is a electronic pulse of, in this case, 8 electrons hitting 8 spins, everything fully quantum. And you see what happens. So the movie shows that the spin remains along the z-axis, a totally non-classical motion, because any LHG equation would require the spins to rotate on the unisphere. These guys never rotate. They just do this. They flip from up to down suddenly and without ever creating rotating components Sx and Sy. The switching is inhomogeneous because you see, for example, these guys have not switched, and moreover, there is again decoherence. Like you could say that in this last guy, the spin is completely gone, expectation value. Because decoherence means that your P vector, Bloch vector, expectation value of spin could be anything, as opposed to classical physics when it has to be one vector of fixed length. So we are having entanglement of many electrons with many spins at zero temperature. Extrapolation is that if I inject 1 billion electrons in a current into a magnet with 1 billion spins, I'm going to create entangled state of all possibilities of 1 billion electrons in 1 billion spins. Whether that is accessible to experiment, that's a story to be deciphered in the future. But this is what you get. A fully quantum description of torque says this. Torque is not caused by non-collinearity. This is the take-home message of this last part. It is actually caused by minority electron down spin hitting up spins. When that happens, you generate every possible state of many body type and their superposition, which is eventually total non-separable state. Then you start looking at individual states of the subsystems, which requires tracing and finding density matrices. Then you get whole this new world of expectation values, which are changing length, decoherence, flipping without ever rotating and stuff like that, none of which will ever be accessible to anything classical because these kind of effects are purely quantum and are not allowed in any kind of LHG type treatment of magnetization dynamics. So then the next step, since this is still 1D and confined to whatever number of spins you can do with...
I really think you have to stop now.
So I'm just saying, like, what would be the next step would be to kind of think, oh, can I extend all of this stuff?
No, I understand, but I think...
Yeah, fine.
Let's thank Bramislav at this point. We're already quite a lot of questions, and I think you're way over time. So maybe one question, if there's any left. No? Then... thanks again, Bronislav.
Okay.